طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, a discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Fahm and is continued in his memory. This is John Roberts. This morning's entire edition of This Week in Palestine consists of our interview with anthropologist, author, activist, and co-founder of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, Jeff Halper. Jeff discusses his latest book, War Against the People, Israel, the Palestinians, and Global Pacification, which is a frightening examination of the Israeli weapons and security development industry. Good morning, Jeff, and welcome to This Week in Palestine. It's wonderful to have you back in the Boston area.
Good to be here again in Boston.
It's always fun. You've written a book, War Against the People, about the burgeoning Israeli weapons and security technology industry. You explore Israel's role in creating the technology for what we call global pacification. What led you to focus on this particular issue, and what role does it play in the in the Israeli occupation strategy?
Well, you know, as an activist for many years, you know, I've been the head of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions for 20 years, but active in Palestine for more than 40 years. You know, the question always kind of nagged at the back of my mind, how does Israel get away with this? You know, we're 60, 70 years past the colonial era. You know, the occupation has been lasting now for 50 years. It's in violation of international law, human rights conventions, in defiance of dozens of UN resolutions, even in defiance of American foreign policy, which is for a two-state solution, and to the degree that the United States is Israel's patron, you would think that would count for something. It's a brutal occupation. So, you know, you see it on TV all the time, there's books, and I don't think there's been a more documented conflict in history. It's happening in the Holy Land, no less, so you'd think that would arouse certain opposition of synagogues and mosques and churches. And it's on the southern border of Europe. This isn't happening in the far-off jungles of the Congo or Vietnam or Colombia. This is on the Mediterranean. And with all of that, Israel gets away with it. And not only gets away with it, but in fact, Israel's international status improves all the time. Not necessarily among the people. I think there's been a change in public opinion, but certainly among governments. A couple of years ago, I was elected to the OECD, which is the club of the most advanced economies in the world. To be elected, you have to be elected unanimously. So here are the most advanced economies of the world, including the United States. But you'd assume then these are the most educated populations and the countries that are most liberal, that give lip service at least to human rights. You know about Norway, Ireland, Sweden. And here they unanimously elect Israel to their club, despite the fact that the guidelines of the OECD require a country to conform to human rights. So the question is, why? What's going on here? And the usual explanations that we hear, AIPAC, you know, the Israeli lobby in Washington, which is powerful, but it's only in the United States. It doesn't run the rest of the world, and it doesn't run the American government either. Christian fundamentalists, Christian Zionists that support Israel, like Sarah Palin or Pat Robertson, well, they also have clout here, but they don't have clout in most other parts of the world that do support Israel. Guilt over the Holocaust might work in Germany. I don't think that motivates the United States in particular. So all those explanations didn't really explain the global phenomenon of why Israel gets the international support it gets. And of course, the big elephant in the room, the big reason is it's a military security and police prowess. In other words, what I'm arguing is that Israel takes what it learned in the occupation on the Palestinians, you know, the weapons that it develops in controlling a population, the security systems it develops, the surveillance systems with more than 600 checkpoints, with thousands of Palestinians going through, the matrix of control, this model of control, permanent control over the occupied territory that Israel has globalized, this has become its main export. In a sense, you might say the occupation, how to control people, which is, of course, of tremendous use to elites all over the world, from the United States and its police forces and so on, and army, down to, you know, the worst warlord in Africa, like Equatorial Guinea, where Israel's very involved. All elites and all governments need these kinds of technologies. And so Israel, I think there's a quid pro quo here, where Israel delivers the means of control, and in return, you know, it's allowed to continue its occupation. That's kind of in a nutshell what I'm arguing.
What role does it play in the occupation? You talk in the book about how Palestine is a kind of a laboratory.
That's right.
Expand on that.
Well, you know, warfare has changed. And you don't have any more, really, war in the conventional sense. Armies fighting armies, countries fighting countries, tanks, fighter airplanes, battleships. That kind of war is really gone. And the new form of warfare is what generals call war amongst the people. In other words, a counterinsurgency, asymmetrical warfare, urban warfare, hybrid warfare, what we see today. What the United States is fighting, like five of those kinds of wars in Somalia, North Africa, Syria, Afghanistan, Iraq, fighting the Mexican drug cartels in Mexico and so on. So these are the new forms of warfare. They're called wars amongst the people. I put it within the capitalist framework. And there's a reason why each country needs Israeli security prowess and works with Israel. But overall, there's the broader issue of world capitalism, which is a system we live in, which really runs the entire world, and is becoming more and more repressive. As resources become scarcer, as more and more people are excluded from the capitalist system, the whole flow of capital is disrupted by resistance. You have resistance abroad, you have resistance here in the United States, everything from Ferguson to Occupy Wall Street and so on. So as the income disparities get huge, and you have the 1%, 99%, literally, and you have more unrest and more resistance because people don't get excluded voluntarily, the whole capitalist system, led by the United States, has to become more repressive. And as it becomes more repressive, these are where you get wars against the people, wars amongst the people, emerging. And I call them wars against the people. That's where the title of my book comes from, because that's really what they are. They're not wars amongst the people, in which the people just happen to be there, but they're against the people, in order to enforce the rule and the hegemony of global capitalism. Now, the United States isn't really geared towards that kind of war. And there's a whole huge internal contradiction here that's interesting. The Pentagon's arsenal is really geared toward interstate warfare. The Pentagon is really geared towards fighting the Soviet Union. not towards these wars amongst the people. Partly because the United States doesn't have much experience in that. You had Vietnam, it didn't do too well. And, you know, in these wars, and then that led to a period of 20 years of what was called the Vietnam Complex, where the United States didn't want to get involved at all. Because it doesn't fight these wars very well. It doesn't have the appropriate weapons. F-16s, F-35s aren't very effective against the people. But in addition to that, wars against the people require smaller arms. Because it's close combat. And you need tear gas, you need different kinds of gases, you need smaller arms, you need drones rather than F-16s. You need smaller armored personnel carriers. They can get into alleyways, not tanks, for example. And so the United States doesn't have the appropriate weaponry, and partly that's because, I think, its military is actually geared to create jobs. And so, you need to build... I mean, the F-35, for example, is this trillion-dollar cutting-edge stealth jet bomber. That's useless. And Robert Gates, when he was the Secretary of Defense, tried to cancel it because it was too expensive and it's not appropriate for wars amongst the people. But he couldn't because it was too far down the pipeline and there's too many jobs. So what happens is if you're making small arms that are appropriate to war against the people, they don't generate many jobs. And so there's not, so you don't want to get into those wars and you don't have the weapons for them. But at the same time, the weapons that you do have that do generate jobs, the Pentagon has a $1 trillion a year budget, are not the types of weapons that are appropriate for the types of wars being fought. So as the United States gets dragged into these wars, because essentially it has to more and more control and repress resistance to world capitalism, including at home, where you have the militarization of the police. So you've got to try to find weaponry that's relevant to the police as well. Israel becomes a go-to place. That's a niche for Israel, because Israel, with the occupation, has been fighting a war against the people, the Palestinians, for 100 years now. So Israel has those weapons and those techniques and those security systems and the experience that the United States doesn't have and a lot of other global powers. And so I take that into account as well. And I think that that's where, in a sense, the occupation becomes in microcosm what's happening globally, between the global north and the global south. And in a sense, the global north, led by the United States, is engaged more and more in a world occupation. So that Israel is able to convince the United States and other countries that it's really indispensable in developing all kinds of techniques and weaponry for the pursuit of that global domination and repression.
Well, does this help explain Gaza? That is to say, people trying to understand why you would bomb Gaza the way and use the kind of weaponry against Gaza in retaliation to them shooting, some minor rockets,
That's right, exactly. And that's right. I mean, you can't explain the attack on Gaza. I mean, any of the attacks, but the last one in 2014, in military terms. The military threat posed by those Qassam rockets to Israel, I mean, they were a nuisance, but they certainly didn't pose any existential threat or major threat. They were very localized. You can't explain the massive disproportional attack on Gaza by those rockets. Something else had to be going on. And I think that something else was two things. One was Israel was saying to the Palestinians, and they were a little bit contradictory things, because on the one hand, Israel's saying to the Hamas, especially, but to the Palestinians, because don't forget the attack on Gaza was preceded by a military operation in the West Bank called Operation Brothers Keeper, The message was zero tolerance. It's over. No more negotiations. No more two states. No more Palestinian rights. We are asserting our control over the entire country. No resistance, period. You're being imprisoned. That was one message. But the other was the use, again, of Gaza, like the West Bank, as a laboratory for perfecting and developing weapons. I have in my book a whole list of weapons that were used for the first time in Gaza. One of them being, for example, the Hermes drone, a new Israeli drone, the Hermes 900. It was even rushed out of production, wasn't even being tested in particular. And then Gaza was literally the testing grounds of that drone and a lot of other kinds of weapons and tactics, not just weapons themselves. So, you know, it's contradictory because on the one hand I argue that the occupied territory is a laboratory, and therefore, and because it's a highly competitive industry, you know, the military, security, and police, if you take those three elements together, because today they're really one package, constitute a $2.5 trillion a year industry. I mean, Israel obviously is one player. It's not the major player, but nevertheless, it's a huge industry to be involved in. And what gives Israel an edge is both that it's plugged into what the new form of warfare is in the world, which is war amongst the people, war against the people, and it's got a laboratory, which is Gaza, the West Bank, and then sometimes southern Lebanon, and other places where it can actually experiment on. So if you see the websites of the Israeli weapons companies that are selling these things, they say combat proven, field tested in Gaza, you see.
Right.
So there's a direct relationship. So what I'm saying is that on the one hand, Israel needs that laboratory. So it has an interest in maintaining a manageable level of conflict with the Palestinians that justifies experimenting with these things. On the other hand, I think it's also trying to end the occupation from the point of view of ending Palestinian resistance and simply incorporating, not Gaza, but incorporating the West Bank into Israel. So, you know, it shows, I think, that there isn't one mind. This isn't a conspiracy. This isn't like, a one-to-one correlation. You know, it's kind of an approach, let's say. I mean, Israel certainly knows it has an occupation. It has a laboratory. But at the same time, that contradicts other interests, especially, let's say, of the settlers and of other right-wing Israelis, of saying, well, let's take over the whole country. We don't want it to be a laboratory. We want it to be the land of Israel. So you have opposing forces, even within the right wing of Israel, that view the occupation in different ways. But certainly I would argue that Israel sees the occupation as a laboratory.
We take great pride in this country in saying that we've addressed or are addressing the kind of Jim Crow segregated society that we've had in our past. And we keep talking about applying human rights standards to other countries that want to relate to us or whatever. And yet we support Israel, which has a de facto segregated society and a de jure, that is a segregated apartheid society by law. And yet the United States, as you point out earlier, the United States sort of just sets aside all those standards.
Uh-huh.
And is this part of the reason that the United States is somehow dependent on Israel for this kind of weaponry or this kind of technology? Does this explain that? Or partially explain
it? Well, it partially explains it. You know, one of the expressions of all of this is Israel's importance in airport security in the United States and in training the American police. So, and in, of course, border controls, where Israel's, you know, the wall that Bush and Trump and everybody want to build with Mexico would be, I mean, Mexico might pay for it, but it's an Israeli, Elbit and Boeing are joining forces and building it. So as, you know, of course, with 9/11 and with the this whole move towards homeland security and mixing domestic concerns like crime, you think about the militarized language, war on crime, war on drugs and so on, the militarization of the police, and this whole concern about terrorism and so on, that's become a very fertile ground for Israel. And what the United States is finding, I think, is that the democratic protections that people are supposed to be given get in the way. And Israel's trying to help the United States deal with that because it has this reputation of being super effective in terms of terrorism, and that's what gives Israel that legitimacy, that authority in this realm. The United States is being transformed into what Israel is, which is a security state. It's moving from being a democracy to being a security state, in which security trumps everything. And you see it today, for example, in this fight between the FBI and Apple over the cell phone.
Right.
I think the vast majority of Americans will side with the FBI. In other words, side with the idea of security that trumps everything over privacy and democratic protections and so on. That's the move towards a security state. Now, there are things within... Now, the United States wants to become that, or at least the ruling classes certainly do. The problem is that you do have certain protections in the United States. One, for example, take one example, ethnic profiling or racial profiling. That's supposed to be illegal. Now, we know, certainly from Ferguson and from a lot of other cases, that in fact the police kind of do that, but they're not supposed to. And airports aren't supposed to. And so you, what happens is you put a lot of emphasis on hardware, on technology to detect, let's say in airports, what people are bringing through, because you can't pull out black people or Arabs or people you suspect, because that's a kind of racial profiling that's illegal in the United States. Well, Israel's whole system is based on that.
Right.
You see, Israel, in fact, if you go to Ben-Gurion Airport, there isn't a tremendous amount of technology. It's all based on interactions. And if you go to the kids, the security people, the young people, in the line before you get to the counter, everybody complains about the dumb questions they ask. You know, what are the names of your kids? You know, what's your birthday? These innocuous kind of dumb questions, but in fact, they can tell from your reactions if you're getting nervous. And of course, they target immediately. You know, you have a certain visa in your passport from an Arab country, or you look Arab, or you have an Arab name, or whatever. I mean, immediately you're taken out. So they do things that you couldn't do in the States. So what's happening is that, in a sense, police forces and security forces here, and conservative politicians, are urging that kind of these practices on the United States. You know, because these are necessary, they would argue, for a security state. Israel now, well, who knows more about security than Israel? This is what Israel does, so we should be doing it. So in fact, these practices trickle in, and they begin to really undermine the democratic protections that citizens have here. So it's a good example of how Israel encourages, you know, this kind of a movement. I ask, you know, Israel trains American police forces. It has all kinds of programs and comes here to train police, and American police go there. And, you know, the question is why? What is Israel training them in? Well, you got to train the LAPD, which is the most brutal police force in the country that invented SWAT teams. What is Israel going to teach
them? Well, even Cambridge sent police.
They all send police.
Sure.
What do they learn? And one of the things that they're learning... Again, not that they're learning. I don't know how much they actually learn. But it's a junket, first of all.
It's a nice trip.
It's a nice trip, and, you know, everybody likes to play with guns, and you get to see how the Israelis deal with terrorists and all that. But beyond that, I think, you know, the police are militarized. They have a militarized mindset. They want to be more macho and more armed and to have more authorities. So, in a sense, I think what happens is that being in Israel, you know, you can go back to your superiors or to the mayor or to the city council or the state legislature, whatever, and you can say, Israel recommends that we restructure our department this way. Israel recommends that we develop these kinds of arms. Israel recommends that we engage more in racial profiling or that we change our procedures for firing. And in a sense, it's what they want to do anyway. It isn't that Israel really invented that. They want to do it anyway, but Israel gives them that legitimacy. Who's going to argue with Israel in terms of terrorism, you see? So in a sense, it's very useful in terms of advancing an agenda that anyway you want to advance, but now you can do it under the guise of an Israeli recommendation. It's very subtle in many ways that Israel works here.
You talk about how in Palestine's Israel issue is becoming less an occupation than a warehousing.
That's right.
We in the United States know about warehousing. We know how to warehouse prisoners a very large degree. And you talk about how this security state really is very helpful to nations that want to warehouse segments of their population, and there certainly are countries all over the world engaged in that. Would you talk a little bit about how Israel plays, how they play that warehouse card?
Well, like I said before, war amongst the people, war against the people, brings together the military and homeland security and local policing. These things that used to be fairly distinct are today coming together more and more. You have the military is being policified as you go out to nation change and regime build and so on, protect resources, the police at home are being militarized, which is clear. So these things begin to come together. So together, they're not, you know, war used to be that you'd fight a war and then you'd win and then, you know, you dictate some terms and go home. But now we're talking about permanent repression. This is a never-ending battle. And in fact, you know, the policing part of it, including prisons, and who you're imprisoning and how you or who are you even repressing? It doesn't always get to prisons. I mean, the you know, repressing black people and the poor people, black people and so on, is an everyday thing. You know, dismantling Occupy Wall Street was a kind of a permanent thing. So that the side of warfare, the war against the people, that's almost invisible, is this whole policing, imprisoning, disciplining aspect. If you think about it, wars are very dramatic. They're events. They have names. The war in Iraq, the Six-Day War, the Vietnam War, the Civil War. I mean, they have names, they have dates, they have beginnings, they have ends, and so on. Whereas we're talking here, in terms of war against the people, about what's called the everyday war. You know, that if war is policing in the world, you're trying to keep the world safe for capitalism, flows of capitalism and domination and so on, and ending resistance, then at home, policing is a form of war, a form of class war. Especially, again, if you get into this issue of the 1% and 99%, and more people are being, including young middle-class people, like in the Occupy movement, that are being excluded from the system more and more. So it's this everyday war of policing and security and repression that becomes really the most important form of war, but it's fairly invisible. Partly because, you know, the police are just around. Their weapons are very unsexy. You know, they're not weapons that, police cars and you get police vans. They're not like F-16s or tanks, you know. And they're ubiquitous. They're just in the woodwork. They're just around. And you can get a cop on your tail near a light. You can ask a cop for directions. And so the repression becomes more invisible, you see. And so warehousing is partly, you know, where you're warehousing prisoners. That's what the word refers to explicitly. But you can also warehouse populations. So I talk about warehousing the Palestinians, and that Israel is turning the whole occupied territory into a mass prison, where their movement is being controlled, their rights are controlled, the food they can use is controlled, everything is controlled.
The roads they can use.
The roads, everything. It's like being in a prison. But you can expand that further. You can talk about the continent of Africa becoming warehoused from the point of view that these are people excluded from the capitalist system, but who aren't allowed to resist as their resources are being taken and they're being impoverished. So warehousing, is a very useful, and so it applies to prisoners in this country, but I think it can be expanded in a wider sense to ghettos and to communities of poor people and reservations for Native Americans.
Right.
And more and more to the 99% that's in the process of being warehoused, and that's all a part again of the war against the people. And again, you know that Israel's certainly not the only actor in this. I'm not saying that, but Israel becomes very useful again because it's very proactive, and it has those kinds of weapons and tactics. So I land last week in Atlanta, Georgia. I'm taken to Georgia State University, okay, to give a talk. I'm looking out the window at the building, and right next door is called the Gillee Center, G-I-L-E-E, if you look it up on the internet. The Georgia International Law Exchange Center. So it turns out that there's a huge center on the campus of Georgia State University, run by Israelis, and run by very pro-Zionist Israeli money. It's the Marcus Foundation. This guy Marcus runs Home Depot. The Home Depot, you know, provides the funding, but it's filled with Israeli instructors, and if you go into the website, all the pictures are these American law enforcement officers from all over the United States being brought to Israel for training. And then Israelis coming here for training, not only, but largely through this Gillee Center in Georgia. So the students, for example, have tried to lock onto that as a BDS target.
Mm-hmm.
On our campus is an Israeli repression institute. They can't get any information. It's a black hole. They can't get the syllabi. They can't get the curriculums. They don't know who's teaching there. They don't know who's studying there. On their campus, in a building, in a university-connected program, they don't know anything about it. So, you know, that's just one example of the degree to which Israel is proactively penetrating into the most sensitive parts of American internal sovereignty, your policing and your communities and your borders and your prisons. So that's where, you know, you can take this idea of warehousing and expand it out into the community where, you know, whatever people threaten the hegemony of capitalism and its workings, can be warehoused by the police using these kinds of tactics and so on, which is a form of imprisonment.
Well, it comes down to how do you control people?
That's right.
And Israel's creating the mechanisms to increasingly be able to control people. Israel has a robust economy. it's developing this security weapons industry, and yet the United States pours more money into Israel than any other nation on earth. Some $3 billion a year, and it's beyond that now.
And, no, it's beyond that.
And now Obama's talking about giving more money to Netanyahu because Netanyahu's nose is out of joint or something. Anyway,
okay. He signed a bill giving Israel $40 billion in new arms over the next 10 years.
So what's going on there? Why this economic subsidy to this large degree? What's going on between these two countries with that kind of money flowing back and forth?
Well, again, on one level, it's a subsidy of the American defense contractors. Not just the Pentagon, of course, but Boeing and Lockheed and Northrop Grumman and a million different local manufacturers. Because of the $40 billion, let's see, over a 10-year period, 70% has to be spent in the United States. So it's not that Israel gets $40 billion to go buy French arms. It's really money doesn't even change hands. It's really a subsidy for the American defense industry. Israel also, of course, tests American weapons. I mean, Israel's getting delivery of a squadron of F-35s before the American Air Force does, because it's a great testing grounds for American weaponry. But in addition to that, Israel is seen, again, as a very useful ally, a very useful agent for pursuing this war against the people in ways that the United States can't or won't or whatever. So unlike other countries, only 70% of that $40 billion has to be spent in the U.S. 30% Israel can take for its own development of its own defense industry. Because, Israel, the United States has an interest in Israel developing these products that then get reintegrated. And don't forget the technological developments. It isn't just weapons, but it's these technologies of control. Israel's the world leader in airport security. Yeah, you got 600 checkpoints that Palestinians go through. And so those kinds of high-tech, Israel's a high-tech leader because its high-tech is connected to the military and surveillance and so on. Well, those technologies that Israel develops, again, get fed back into the American military and commercial technologies. So it's an investment. That 30% is an investment that comes back to the United States. And it's a joint development of projects and programs and so on. But at the same, that leaks into other areas. I mean, Israel's the world's leader in the applications of nanotechnology to military. But nanotechnology has tremendous other applications in the biomedical field, for example, in energy. So that it also, in a way, if you look at it that way, the United States is sort of investing in a high-tech industry in Israel that really flows back into the United States in very, and spills out into other areas. And at the same time, of course, Israel has privileged access to American military technology. So it's basically expanding the military and wider technologies of the United States over to Israel. Intel, for example, and we all have Intel in our computers, is really a military company. I mean, the basis of all these technologies is the military. They have the billions of dollars. So they develop technologies for their use and bring them to a point where then commercial companies can kick in and use them. The internet itself was developed by the Pentagon. Yeah, Intel has three research and developing centers, a Silicon Valley, part of which is Israeli. There's a part of the Silicon Valley, it's called the Humus Valley. So you have a real strong component of Israelis there in California, and Ireland, and Israel. So that the connection between these technologies and eventually spill out into our PCs, and the military and Israel are very... So in a sense, I think the United States gets a lot out of it, including, again, those types of weapons and technologies of repression that Israel is very good at developing.
Okay, so if that's the case, and you've painted this portrait of how our defense industries are interrelated, how we're scratching each other's back, how money flows back and forth, supporting jobs in this country, etc. In your book, one fascinating point was that you exposed how Israel is becoming a major supporter and supplier of weapons for China, for India, for countries that we could argue at times are our enemies, and that may be a strong word, but here we are concerned about China and what's happening in the South China Sea, etc., and this partner of ours is arming them to the teeth.
Exactly.
So,
that's right.
How long is this going? How do these partners deal with that?
That's right. I mean, first of all, they're a part of the capitalist system. They're simply rivals in terms of who's going to take over the capitalist system. I mean, China, you know, has a brand of state, and Brazil, the other BRICS countries, India and so on, have a form of state capitalism. It's different from American, but it's still capitalism. And it still needs access to the world's resources and so on. So it's really competition over control, or at least major access to the world economy that we're talking about. You know, Kissinger used to say, our friend Henry, he used to say the countries don't have friends, they have interests. And so you see that in terms of who Israel is working with. I mean, Israel, on the one hand, if you ask your member of Congress, why do you support Israel? Uncritically, the way you do, and almost all of them do, the answer is because Israel's our most loyal ally in the Middle East. But actually, if you look at Israel's military, security, police relationships, Israel, it turns out, is number 2, 3, 4 arms supplier to China, which is the major rival of the United States.
Right.
You're moving a whole 6th fleet into the South Pacific to contain China. So, and of course, it's not just security and military, it's American military technologies. That if you get into war with China, you're going to be fighting is American technologies built into Chinese weapons. You know, so it's a good example of how there are no friends when you're dealing with arms and all that money and even the whole capitalist system, you know. But that's really the reality, and that is that Israel does not have all its eggs in the American basket. It's willing to supply all these BRICS countries that are the major rivals of Euro-American hegemony. That's fine with Israel. It doesn't care about Euro-American. It wants its own, to pursue its own interests everywhere. It's very strong in all the BRICS countries. And that's a part of it. You know, you have to really understand that, and it's true of capitalism in general. I mean, capitalism certainly isn't contained by the United States. I mean, that's where the and Europe is a concentration of the capitalist decision makers, the ruling classes, but they're not so much loyal to any particular country. They're loyal to their profits. So you can see that with outsourcing and what's happening to the American economy. Israel has that, you know, Israel, I think, sees itself as serving the hegemons. The hegemons are not country-specific. The hegemons are the ruling classes, who has the defense industries, who has the big corporations, who needs their stuff. And from that point of view, you know, I found that tracing Israel's involvement in the world's arms industry, because, you know, it's a small country, it has to scramble, it can't be too choosy, and so it can't be like the United States with a huge budget, and the United States can say, we're not going to do business with China. Okay, Israel can't do that.
Do you think the United States can still blow the whistle on Israel? I mean, we keep hearing this that,
You're right.
I'm wondering, do you think Israel's with its contrast with China and India, as you say, getting, you know.
Well, Israel's trying to be careful a little bit. Israel pulls back when it has to. There was, in fact, I talk about it in my book, in 2003, Richard Perle, who was one of the Jewish neocons, with Wolfowitz and all these other guys. Richard Perle was the assistant secretary of defense. Super pro-Israel, Jewish, neocon. But it got to a point with Israel's passing American military technology to China, especially through the Falcon. Israel was selling these Falcon surveillance planes to China, where Richard Perle, a Jewish neocon pro-Israel, threatened Israel that the United States would cut off diplomatic relations with it if it didn't stop the Falcon deal with China. So it's gotten to a point where even in the Bush administration, they were talking about maybe cutting relations with Israel. I mean, there are red lines.
Yeah.
And Israel pulled back. It canceled the Falcon deal, which was a big thing for Israel. I think until today, the guy that was ahead of the director general of the Israeli Ministry of Defense can't come to the United States. There is that a certain sensitivity. But I think Israel, knows how to play the game, and it pulls back at certain times. It pushes the envelope, certainly.
Yeah.
And then it relies on the fact that members of Congress support it. It doesn't really care about the administration.
No,
it has congressional support.
We saw that this past few months.
And that's what gives it much more leeway than it would have if it was simply up to the administration.
Yeah. Well, we've run out of time. I think we'll have to leave it there, unfortunately. Jeff Albert's book is War Against the People, Israel, the Palestinians, and Global Pacification. It is published by Pluto Press. Thanks, Jeff, and thanks.
All right, thanks for having me on.
All your good work and good luck with the book.
Okay, thank you much.
That was anthropologist and activist Jeff Halper, co-founder of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. Thanks for tuning in, and this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.